Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
It is great to be here.
Today we are going to ask a question that sounds incredibly simple on the surface, but if you actually stop and let it sink in, it completely upends how we look at the world.
It really does. It's one of those questions that seems so obvious until you try to actually answer it.
The question is simply, what actually matters? And I don't mean that in a live, laugh, love kind of way.
Right, not a spiritual or self-help angle.
No, exactly. I don't mean it in a spiritual sense necessarily. I mean structurally.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about a successful society or a wealthy nation or even a successful life, what are we actually counting?
We have a default setting for this. We almost always talk about money.
We do.
We talk about GDP. We talk about the stock market. We talk about salaries. We define the standard of living almost exclusively as a dollar figure.
Right. If you make $100,000, you have a higher standard of living than someone making $30,000.
That is the baseline assumption of our entire global economy.
But, and here is the hook that really grabbed me when I was going through the stack of research you sent over.
Yeah.
What happens to that standard of living if you have $1 million in the bank, but the air outside your window is completely unbreathable?
Or if the water coming out of your tap is toxic?
Exactly.
Or if you have the money to pay for a massive hospital bill, but the medical system itself has collapsed and there are literally no doctors.
At that point, the money is just, what is it? It's paper?
It's paper, or it's digits on a server somewhere.
Right. It has completely lost its connection to the reality of staying alive.
And that is the absolute crux of what we are talking about today. We have confused the symbol of value, which is money, with the actual substance of value, which is life itself.
And today we are going to explore a framework that tries to untangle that confusion. We are diving into a fascinating and honestly pretty radical critique of how we think about social justice.
Yes, this is the life value framework.
And this comes primarily from the philosophers Jeffrey Noonan and John McMurtry.
Specifically, we are drawing a lot from a collection of their papers in studies in social justice.
Their mission here is bold. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are arguing that our dominant view of justice, the one that shapes our laws, our economies, our international treaties, is fundamentally flawed.
They argue it's flawed because it's based entirely on money and abstract individual rights rather than what they call the life ground.
The life ground. I want to get into that term because it sounds very earthy.
It is very earthy. It's biological and it's social.
Okay.
It's the idea that justice shouldn't just be about who has the most stuff or who has the most freedom to buy stuff. It should be about securing the actual necessities required for life to exist and to flourish.
Okay. But before we get to the solution, we have to really understand the problem. To understand why this is such a critique, we need to know who exactly they are criticizing.
Right. We need the antagonist.
Who is the villain, or at least the representative of the status quo in this story? Because usually when we talk about justice in a Western world, there is one giant shadow cast over everything.
And that shadow belongs to John Rawls.
The final boss of political philosophy.
Essentially, yes. I mean, if you have taken a philosophy 101 class or any political science course, you have heard of John Rawls.
He wrote A Theory of Justice back in 1971.
Right. And even if you haven't read him, you are living in the house he built. Rawls is the absolute titan of modern liberalism.
He's the guy with the veil of ignorance, right?
Precisely. His big thought experiment was this. Imagine you are designing a society from scratch, but you have no idea who you are going to be in it.
You don't know your class, your race, your gender.
Right. You don't know if you'll be rich or poor, talented or disabled. You are behind this veil of ignorance. And Rawls asked, what kind of rules would you agree to under those conditions?
And the logic is that you would play it safe. You would want a strong safety net because you might end up at the absolute bottom.
Right. You'd want fairness. But here is the crucial part for our discussion today. Rawls focused on distributing what he called primary goods.
Primary goods.
He argued that a just society is one that fairly distributes things that every rational person is presumed to want.
And what are those things according to Rawls?
Rights, liberties, opportunities, and crucially, income and wealth.
Okay, so he literally baked money right into the definition of the good life.
He did. He treated income as a purely neutral good. A rational person always wants more income because income is just the means to get whatever else you happen to want.
I mean, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I am going to play devil's advocate here immediately because money gives you options.
It does.
If I have money, I can buy food, I can buy a house, I can travel. Why is it wrong to assume a rational person always wants more money?
Well, it's not wrong in a vacuum, but Rawls takes it a step further with his difference principle.
What's that?
He admitted that economic inequality would inevitably happen, but he said that inequality is okay. It is just if that inequality ultimately benefits the least well-off in society.
And how do we measure that benefit to the least well-off?
Purchasing power.
Of course. So if the rich get massively richer, that is fine as long as the poor get a little bit more money too.
Exactly. It's the classic rising tide lifts all boats idea.
It assumes that more is always better. More growth, more wealth.
And this is exactly where Noonan and McMurtry step in and say stop. They argue that Rawls, and really mainstream economics in general, has completely abstracted the debate away from what actually matters most.
They are basically saying, we're arguing about how to fairly split the check while the restaurant is actively burning down around us.
That's a very apt analogy. Noonan argues that Rawls confuses capitalist market values with human life values.
How so?
Well, Rawls assumes that an unlimited demand for resources, an unlimited desire for more primary goods, is entirely rational.
But isn't it? I mean, if I want a bigger house, a faster car, more gadgets, that is just human nature, right?
Noonan argues it is objectively irrational because we live on a finite planet with a very delicate biosphere.
Right, the physical reality of the world.
If everyone demands unlimited resources, we destroy the environment. We destroy the very sources of life. If your supposedly rational demand for more stuff leads to the collapse of the ecosystem you depend on to breathe, then by definition, it wasn't rational.
It was suicidal.
Exactly. It was suicidal. Rawls looks at the economy and asks, how do we distribute the income? Noonan and McMurtry look at the physical reality of the world and ask, does the system actually allow life to continue?
That is a heavy pivot. It is like saying, it is rational to eat as much as possible. Well, up to a point, sure.
Yeah.
But if you eat until your stomach bursts, that wasn't rational at all.
Right. So we have this massive clash. On one side, you have the money value view, which is all about accumulating wealth and rights to income.
And on the other side, the life value view.
Yes.
So if we aren't using money as the baseline metric, what are we actually using?
We use the life ground.
Define that for us. Because life grounds could mean anything from soil to some sort of abstract metaphor.
It is defined as everything required for the survival and development of human and ecological life.
Okay, so breathable, air, potable, water, space to move.
Yes, and also effective interaction, like love, care, socialization.
The absolute basics. But it feels like it encompasses more than just bare survival.
It absolutely does. It is survival and development. It is about human capacities. But the core conflict McMurtry identifies here is between two fundamentally different value sequences.
Okay, let's get into these sequences because this is really the heart of the theory. And I think this is where the major aha moment happens for a lot of people diving into this.
Okay, so first you have the money code. This is the code of the market. The formula is simply money leads to commodity, which leads to more money.
Money commodity.
Yeah.
More money. MCM prime for the Marxists listening to us today.
Right. But you really don't have to be a Marxist to see how this operates everywhere.
Yeah.
Think of a standard private equity firm.
Okay.
They start with money. They buy a company that is the commodity. They strip it. They sell the assets. Maybe they fire half the staff, and then they sell it for more money.
The goal isn't to make good products. The goal isn't to employ people or serve a community. The entire goal is just that final step, more money. The commodity is just a vehicle.
Exactly. In that sequence, life itself, human beings, nature, the community, is just a means to an end. We are just inputs used to create more money.
And the alternative sequence.
That is the life code.
Yeah.
And that sequence goes, life leads to means of life, which leads to more life.
Life, means of life, more life.
In this view, you start with life. A person, a community, an ecosystem. You use resources. Those are the means of life, like food, housing, education, technology. And the ultimate goal is more life.
Now, when you say more life, do you mean strictly quantity, like having more babies or living to be 150 years old?
Not necessarily quantity, although physical survival is obviously the baseline. It really means quality. It means deeper and richer capacities.
Like what?
Being able to think more clearly, feel more deeply, act more freely. It means a flourishing, diverse ecosystem.
So the material things are just tools.
Right. In the sequence, the material goods, the houses, the cars, the money itself are just the means. The end goal is preserving and extending life capacities.
So it completely flips the script.
Yeah.
In the money code, life is just a tool to get money. In the life code, money is just a tool to get life.
Precisely. And McMurtry argues that we are currently living under a global corporate rights system that is almost entirely governed by the money code.
It treats the destruction of life as an externality.
Yes. If a process makes money, it is deemed good in the market sense, even if it actively destroys the life ground in the process.
This reminds me of that part in our research notes about the blind spot of other major philosophers like Amartya Sen, Amartya Nussbaum.
Ah, yes, the capabilities approach.
Right. Because they talk a lot about capabilities, which sounds an awful lot like life capacities.
It is very close. Sen and Nussbaum are brilliant, and their work moved the needle a lot in international development. They basically said, hey, GDP is a terrible metric. Let's look at what people can actually do and be their capabilities.
But McMurtry argues they miss the mark in a really crucial way.
They do. They fail to strictly define what a need actually is.
How so?
They leave the concept of a need open to subjective preference or market demand. They really don't want to be paternalistic and tell people what they should or shouldn't want.
So if I strongly feel I need a luxury yacht to fully express my capability as a master sailor.
In their framework, it is very hard to argue against that. If you say, I have reason to value this yacht, it basically counts as a capability to be protected.
And McMurtry says, no, that is incredibly dangerous.
Because if you don't define need objectively, you simply cannot distinguish between a vital need for clean drinking water and a subjective need for a Ferrari.
And in a world of limited resources, that confusion is literally fatal.
Exactly. If we treat the billionaire's desire for a third vacation home as morally equal to the unhoused person's need for basic shelter, the market will always serve the billionaire because he has the money to back up his demand.
So how do we actually define a need then? Because knee is a very tricky word in English. My kids tell me they absolutely need the newest gaming console. I feel like I need a cup of coffee every morning to function.
Right, we use the word very casually. Well, McMurtry provides a very strict, almost scientific definition. He calls it the N criterion.
The N criterion. It sounds like a secret weapon from a spy movie. The N criterion.
It does sound intense, but it is very practical. The definition is this. N is a need if and only if and to the extent that deprivation of N results in a reduction of life capacity.
Okay, let me make sure I have this. Deprivation equals a reduction of life capacity.
That's the test.
Okay, let's test this out. We're going to run some scenarios through the N criterion right now.
Yeah.
Scenario one is water.
Okay, if you are deprived of water, what happens?
I get thirsty, then I get severely dehydrated, then my organs shut down and I die. My life capacity hits zero.
Correct. So that is a high necessity. Water is an absolute biological need. Let's do scenario two, literacy. Reading and writing.
Yeah, this one is trickier. If I am deprived of literacy, I don't die physically. My heart keeps beating. My lungs keep working.
But what happens to your capacity to interact with the human world?
It shrinks drastically. I can't read the instructions on a medicine bottle. I can't vote in an informed way. I can't navigate a legal contract.
So your cognitive and social capacities are severely reduced.
Yes, definitely.
Exactly. So under the N criterion, literacy is absolutely a need. It is a need on a different timeline and a different dimension, mental and social, rather than immediate biological, but it is a vital need.
Okay, scenario three. A luxury yacht.
Run it through the criterion. If you are deprived of a yacht, what happens?
I might be really bummed out. I might be envious of my rich neighbor who have one.
But does your organic life capacity, your fundamental ability to think, move, breathe, feel actually diminish?
No. I am just a guy without a boat. My capacities are exactly the same.
Precisely. Therefore, under the N criterion, a yacht is not a need. It is simply a want, a subjective desire.
This gives us a really objective way to prioritize policy. A just society is one that ensures the universal provision of these necessities, these N factors, before it even begins to worry about providing luxuries.
Yes. And this brings us to another major concept from the readings, which is the life coherence principle.
This feels like the flip side of the coin. If we have universal needs, we must also have limits.
Exactly. The life coherence principle states that valid rights must be compossible.
Compossible. That is a $10 philosophy word.
It just means they must be able to exist together without destroying the overarching system that supports them all.
Give me an example of that.
It means my right to X cannot actively destroy the life support system that is required for your right to Y.
So let's apply this. I don't have a right to unlimited capacity development. I don't have a right to develop my capacity for, say, setting massive forest fires for fun.
Right. Or even just unlimited industrial consumption. If your hyperconsumption of resources creates toxic pollution that degrades my fundamental ability to breathe, your supposed right to consume is not valid under the life coherence principle.
Because it is not compatible with my right to breathe.
Exactly. It rejects the modern libertarian idea that freedom just means doing whatever you want as long as you can pay the market price for it.
It anchors human freedom in biology and physics. It anchors it directly in the life ground. You simply cannot have a right to destroy the very conditions of life.
Right. It's a hard limit based on reality, not abstract legal theory.
So we have the philosophy down. We have the objective definition of a need. But how do we actually do this in the real world? How do we systematically provide these needs? Because the market is incredibly good at providing yachts, if you have the cash, but it is sometimes terrible at providing clean water to everyone.
This is where we get to one of the most important concepts in this entire deep dive. Honestly, if you take only one thing away from this whole discussion, it should be this concept.
All right, lay it on us.
The civil commons.
The civil commons. Now, I have to be honest. When I hear the word commons, I immediately picture a literal sheep pasture in a medieval English village. Just peasants grazing their livestock on shared grass.
And that is a valid part of the historical origin of the term. But McMurtry expands this definition massively to fit the modern world.
How does he define it?
He defines the civil commons as any cooperative human construction that protects and or enables universal access to life goods.
Any cooperative human construction. That is a huge umbrella.
It is massive. It is not just the village pasture. It includes public health care systems. It includes universal public education, sewer systems, public libraries,
right,
workplace safety regulations, even the World Wide Web in its original open source intent, and sidewalks.
Wait, sidewalks?
Think about it. A sidewalk is a shared public space. It is paid for collectively, usually by local taxes. It allows anyone, rich or poor, young or old, able-bodied or in a wheelchair, to move safely without paying a toll.
I never actually thought of a sidewalk as a radical act of social cooperation.
But it is a purely non-market space. You don't swipe a credit card to walk on the pavement. It protects life by keeping pedestrians out of high-speed traffic, and it enables the capacity of movement. It is a perfect classic piece of the civil commons.
And the crucial distinction here is that the civil commons is fundamentally based on shared life interest, not private profit.
Exactly. The goal of a public library isn't to extract money from you every time you read a book. The goal is to ensure that you actually can read books regardless of your income.
But according to the sources, this civil commons is currently under severe attack.
McMurtry describes it as an unseen war. He argues there is a brutal structural conflict happening globally between the civil commons and the global corporate rights system.
And the primary weapon in this unseen war is privatization.
Right. The mechanic is privatization. When you take a vital piece of the civil commons, let's say a municipal water utility or a public transit system, and you privatize it, you are literally changing its underlying code.
You are switching it from the life code to the money code.
You are taking an institution that was designed for universal access and turning it into an engine profit maximization.
And to make a profit in a market, you often need scarcity.
Right. If everyone has free, abundant water, you can't sell water at a premium. So privatization very often involves intentionally defunding the commons to create a scarce market.
There was a really stark, terrifying example of this in the reading, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Yes. This is a chilling case study. McMurtry argues that Katrina was not just a natural disaster. It was fundamentally a system-made disaster.
Because the levees physically failed.
Because the civil commons had been systematically stripped for decades. The public infrastructure, the levees, the public rescue services, the emergency housing support, all of it had been defunded and neglected to save money or to lower taxes.
The logic of the money code basically said, why spend millions of dollars maintaining levees for a massive storm that might not happen this year, that is economically inefficient.
Right. So when the storm actually hit, the protective shell around the city was paper thin.
And then look at the immediate response. McMurtry describes how private interests actually predated on the disaster.
You saw private security firms rushing in private reconstruction contractors. The response was largely about securing high-value private property and finding lucrative profit opportunities in the cleanup rather than prioritizing saving lives based on urgent human need.
So the people who died in the floods, they didn't just die because of wind and water. They died because the social immune system of the city had been intentionally turned off.
That is a perfect metaphor. The civil commons is literally our social immune system. When you starve it of resources, the very first environmental shock that comes along can kill you.
That puts a very different spin on the phrase natural disaster.
It makes you realize that what we casually call disasters are often just the inevitable mathematical result of prioritizing money value over life protection.
Okay, let's move from the broad theoretical framework to some very specific practical applications. The research highlights three specific areas where this exact battle is playing out right now.
Food, education, and human rights.
Let's start with something we all literally have to do every single day to survive. Eat.
Right. This section draws heavily on the work of Jennifer Sumner. She analyzes the global food system strictly through this life value lens.
And I'm guessing she is not a huge fan of how it is currently set up.
Not exactly. She argues that the modern corporate food system treats food strictly as a commodity. It follows the money sequence perfectly. Money to commodity to more money.
Which means the actual ultimate goal of the massive food industry isn't feeding people.
No. The goal is selling a product at a profit. If that product happens to be highly nutritious and affordable, that is great. But if a corporation can make significantly more profit by selling low-nutrition, ultra-processed, high-sugar food, the money code dictates that they must do that to satisfy shareholders.
This explains why we have the global paradox of hunger amidst plenty. We produce more than enough food globally to feed every single human on the planet comfortably, but millions of people still starve.
Because they can't pay. In the logic of the money code, if you have a biological need for food, meaning you are literally starving to death, but you have zero money, you represent zero demand in the market.
Your life need is completely invisible to the mainstream economists because it isn't backed by cash.
Exactly.
There was that ridiculous example in the text about ketchup. I genuinely thought this was an urban legend, but it is apparently real.
Oh, the U.S. school lunch program. Yes, it is very real. In the early 1980s, under the Reagan administration, there was a massive political push to slash the federal budget, including cutting costs in public school lunches.
To save money. Serve the money code.
Right. And to still legally meet the dietary requirements for a balanced meal while spending significantly less money, new regulations were proposed to literally classify ketchup as a vegetable.
That is just, I mean, it is funny in a dark way, but it is deeply tragic. It is the absolute perfect example of money value completely overriding life value. Ketchup, red vegetables are good money is saved. Problem solved, right?
But nutritionally, in terms of actually building the loft capacity of a growing child, it is a disaster. It essentially reduces the long-term health of the children just to save a few digits on a government budget sheet.
It treats the child's physical body as an annoying expense that costs money rather than as the fundamental life ground that needs to be nurtured.
Exactly.
So what is Sumner's alternative here? A civil commons food system.
Yes. She argues for treating food much more like a basic public utility. The overarching goal should be the sustainable, reliable provision of nutritious food for all people.
Some more local control over agricultural land.
Local control actively supporting small farmers so they can actually earn a living producing real food and viewing basic food security as a non-negotiable human right, not just a market outcome.
Kind of like how we view water coming from the tap, mostly as a public right?
Right. Imagine if we treated basic healthy food the way we treat public libraries. You just walk in and get the apples and the bread because you are a human being who needs apples and bread.
It sounds incredibly radical today, but for most of human history, the commons was exactly where everyday people got their food, the shared village pasture, the community garden. We have just enclosed all those commons and put a barcode and a price tag on absolutely everything.
We enclosed the physical commons, and now we are enclosing the mental commons.
Which is a perfect pivot to our second major application, education. This part is based on Howard Woodhouse's work.
Yes. Woodhouse looks at what he calls the mental life ground. Because just as the physical body needs food to develop, the human mind needs knowledge.
But universities today, I mean, they feel very corporate. I get emails from my old university, and they read exactly like corporate shareholder reports. Yeah. We are expanding our global brand. We are optimizing our real estate assets.
That is exactly his critique. He talks extensively about the corporatization of the modern university, the shift toward a strict market model of education.
Where the student is literally viewed as the customer, and the degree is the product being sold.
Exactly. And in this model, knowledge itself becomes private property. It gets locked behind patents, massive tuition fees, and academic paywalls.
The logic for the student is purely financial. I am going to buy this expensive knowledge now so I can sell my labor for a much higher price later.
It is viewed purely as an investment in your personal money sequence. I pay $50,000 now so I can make $100,000 later.
Right. But Woodhouse argues that knowledge by its very fundamental nature is a non-zero-sum good.
This is key.
Explain the difference.
Well, a zero-sum good is bound by physical scarcity. If I have a sandwich and I share half of it with you, I literally have less sandwich. That is zero sum.
Okay.
But if I have a great idea or a scientific discovery and I share it with you, I don't lose the idea. I still have it. In fact, the idea might actually get much better because you might add your own insights to it.
So knowledge actually grows when it is shared.
Exactly. So treating knowledge as private property, artificially locking it up behind paywalls to extract profit, is actually contrary to the very nature of knowledge itself.
It creates completely artificial scarcity. It starves the mental life ground.
Woodhouse gives a really fascinating historical example of an alternative approach. The People's Free University of Saskatchewan.
The PFU.
Yeah.
I loved reading about this experiment. It operated completely outside of normal administrative control, right?
Completely. There was no tuition, there were no grades, and no corporate sponsors dictating the curriculum.
The motto was literally just friends educating friends.
That was it. It was about learning purely for the sake of expanding life capacity, fostering curiosity, critical thinking, and genuine community connection, rather than learning just to acquire a corporate credential.
But let me be the skeptic for just a second here.
Yeah.
Without a formal credential, does that kind of education actually help you get a job in the real world?
Maybe not directly in terms of a resume, but that wasn't the point. It fundamentally demonstrated that people deeply want to learn regardless of the job market. They have an innate hunger for it.
The PFU showed that the human need for education exists completely independently of the capitalist market. People showed up in their free time just to feed their minds.
It is the library model applied to higher education. And Woodhouse argues we desperately need to defend the public university as a vital civil commons rather than letting it slide completely into becoming just a taxpayer-funded job training center for major corporations.
Well, let's move into the third and final application section, human rights and international law. This is drawing on the work of Barrichello and Johnstone.
Yes. Now, usually when we talk about human rights in the mainstream media, we are talking about civil and political rights, free speech, voting rights, freedom of religion.
Which are obviously incredibly important.
They are vital. But Barrichello and Johnstone focus our attention on the other major set of rights, economic, social, and cultural rights.
Specifically looking at the ICSCR Treaty.
The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. It is a foundational UN treaty. And unlike, say, the U.S. Constitution, which mostly focuses on negative rights, meaning freedom from government interference, the ICSCR focuses heavily on human needs.
It essentially focuses directly on the life ground.
Exactly. It explicitly outlines the right to food, the right to housing, the right to health, and the right to education.
But hold on. We hear these sweeping phrases all the time from politicians. Everyone has a right to a home. Everyone has a right to health. But in practice, are these just noble aspirations? Are they just nice wishes? Like, it would be super nice if everyone had a house, but realistically, we just can't afford it.
The authors forcefully argue no. They argue these are binding legal obligations, and they use this incredibly powerful concept in international law called the minimum core.
Which connects perfectly back to McMurtry's End Criterion.
Exactly. The state has an absolute baseline obligation to ensure the minimum core of biological and social survival for all its citizens.
So if people are actively starving on the streets, the state is actively violating their human rights, just as surely as if it were throwing them in a secret prison without a trial.
But our current society doesn't usually see it that way. If someone starves or freezes to death, we call it a tragic personal failure or an economic inevitability. If a journalist is censored, we correctly call it a rights violation.
That is a massive blind spot. Yeah. And it seems like we have culturally prioritized property rights over actual life rights.
We absolutely have. Barrichello and Johnstone point out that property rights, meaning the right to accumulate unlimited private wealth, consistently override these fundamental life rights in daily practice.
This actually makes me think of the notes we had on migrant worker activism. This fits right in here.
Oh, absolutely. It is a perfect real-world example of this clash.
Because when you look at how migrant agricultural workers are treated, the people actually growing and harvesting the food we eat, they are often completely excluded from the civil commons.
They are brought in purely as units of labor for the money sequence. They are often denied basic minimum core rights, like safe housing access to local health care or workplace safety protections.
Right, and their activism is essentially a demand to be recognized not just as labor inputs, but as human beings entitled to the life grounds.
Yeah.
They're fighting for that minimum core.
Exactly. They are demanding what Sen and Nussbaum might call combined capabilities, but grounded in real physical needs. It is about saying human rights cannot just be abstract legal fictions on paper while our physical bodies are being exploited and degraded.
So if a corporate landlord evicts a family because they can't pay skyrocketing rent and that family ends up sleeping in a tent on the street?
Our current legal system entirely protects the landlord's property right. The armed police will actually come to enforce the eviction.
But the life value framework forces us to ask, what about the family's human right to housing? What about the massive reduction in their life capacity?
It completely reframes the eviction from a standard legal procedure into an active human rights violation.
And the authors argue, we don't even need to invent radical new laws to fix this. The ICSCR treaty is already signed and there.
Right. We just need to interpret and enforce existing international law through the life value lens. We need to judge the success of states not by their stock market returns, but by their actual performance in ensuring this minimum core for everyone.
It's a total shift in our societal metrics. Moving from measuring money to measuring life.
Which brings us to the grand synthesis of all these ideas. Because if we fundamentally change the goal of society, we have to completely change how we define basic concepts like work and success.
The sources talk about this idea of the human vocation. Let's unpack that.
McMurtry fundamentally redefines work. Currently in our economy, work is narrowly defined as selling your labor for money.
Right. If you don't get a paycheck, you aren't working.
Exactly. So if you are a full-time volunteer caregiver looking after your aging sick parent, the economy says you are not working. You are economically inactive. You are contributing absolutely nothing to the GDP.
Which is completely insane because caregiving is one of the most essential tasks for sustaining human life.
It is the bedrock of the life ground. So McMurtry proposes replacing this with the concept of the human vocation.
How does he define it?
The definition is simply contributing to the provision of universal life goods.
So if you are growing healthy food, teaching a neighborhood child, caring for a sick person, designing the safer bridge, or cleaning up a local river, you are fulfilling the human vocation.
Whether you are formally paid a wage for it or not, the underlying logic is highly reciprocal. You have universal right to receive life goods from the commons, like clean water and education, and therefore you have a corresponding social obligation to contribute to the maintenance of that civil commons.
It is a continuous cycle. You take from the commons to live, and you give back to the commons to let others live.
And to actually measure this on a macro level, they propose a new metric called the Universal Well-Being Index, or the WBI.
This would be the replacement for GDP.
Yes. GDP measures the total volume of money changing hands, even if that money is spent on cleaning up an oil spill or treating cancer caused by pollution. GDP goes up when bad things happen.
The WBI is different. What is actually on the checklist?
It is a direct checklist of the life ground. It measures the universal provision of 7 key areas.
Number 1.
Atmospheric goods. Are we providing clean air and safe sunlight?
2 is bodily goods.
Yes. Access to nutritious food and clean water. 3 is home goods, which means safe, secure shelter.
4 is environmental goods.
Intact, flourishing ecosystems and green spaces. 5 is social goods, reliable care networks, and physical safety from violence.
6 is cultural goods.
Universal access to the arts, libraries, and education. And finally, 7 is vocational goods.
Meaning everyone has the opportunity to make a meaningful contribution to fulfill their human vocation.
Right. Imagine if the nightly news reported on that index every evening instead of the Dow Jones.
Like the anchor saying, well, today the Dow is down 50 points, but the bodily goods index is up 2%. So it was a great day.
It would completely transform how we govern and how we vote. Because right now, under our current metrics, we can have a supposedly booming stock market while simultaneously experiencing a collapsing ecological system and rising homelessness.
Well, the life value economy would make that kind of cognitive dissonance impossible to ignore.
It forces reality back into economics.
So to kind of wrap this massive topic up, we have gone from discussing the basic necessity of breathable air to defining the exact scientific nature of a human need.
We looked at the invisible but essential infrastructure of the civil commons.
The unseen war of privatization. We applied it to our food systems and our universities. And finally, we looked at a totally new way of measuring human success.
It truly is a total paradigm shift. It moves us away from defining primary goods as just money and abstract rights, and moves us toward defining primary goods as the actual physical and social requirements of life itself.
And it really makes you realize just how incredibly dependent we are on that civil commons every single day.
We really are. We love to think of ourselves as these rugged, independent individuals, but without the public sewers, the shared sidewalks, the clean air regulations, we honestly don't last very long.
We are fragile biological organisms first and economic agents second.
Exactly.
So here is a final provocative thought for everyone listening today to mull over. McMurtry suggests that the very phrase right to life has been deeply co-opted in our culture.
Yes. It is usually deployed in a very specific, narrow political debate.
But if we step back and take those words literally, the right to life, it actually becomes the most radical, overarching demand possible.
Because a genuine right to life logically implies an absolute right to the means of life.
Exactly. You simply cannot claim to have a right to life if you do not have a guaranteed right to clean water, to nutritious food, to safe shelter.
Without guaranteed access to the means, the right itself is completely empty. It is a ghost.
So as you go about your week, ask yourself this. Are our current celebrated freedoms, our freedom to endlessly accumulate wealth, to hyper-consume, to completely ignore the health of the commons, are those freedoms actually destroying the very ground we stand on?
Are we trading our actual life ground for a slightly bigger bank balance?
That is the big question. Thanks for diving deep with us today. We will see you next time.
Thanks for listening.